Hello and welcome to a special edition of This Side Up, the official podcast of StealthyBox.com. I'm your host and editor-in-chief, Joe Garcia. And this is a special edition of the show because, A, we haven't done one of these in a while. That probably won't change very soon. But I was also in Seattle for the better part of a week, seeing the city and also missing out at PAX with fellow gamers and developers. And I was able to round a few of them up to talk to me about their wares. And first up, we have Kentucky Corporation founder and CEO Brian Stoller, who brought Dragon Fantasy Book 2 to the show. And that is a PlayStation 3 and PlayStation Vita cross-buy game that will be out, I believe, next week. So let's have a listen to that. Alright, so this is Joe Garcia from StealthyBox.com, and I'm here with...
I am Brian Soller, the president and founder of Muteki Corporation.
And what are we looking at here?
We are looking at Dragon Fantasy Book 2 for the PlayStation Vita and PlayStation 3. It's a kind of old-school, heavily 16-bit inspired JRPG. Think Chrono Trigger, Final Fantasy VI, Lufia 2... Kind of trying to take the best from all of these old-school Super Nintendo RPGs and kind of make, well, kind of take their best parts and put them together into one game, and then add to that, you know, some of the modern niceties that people are used to these days, like quest logs, so you don't have to remember the 18 tasks you're supposed to be doing.
You don't need a notebook next to you, or even a craft paper, maybe.
Exactly.
You keep it, right?
So obviously, Book 2 is the sequel to Book 1.
It is.
So as a 16-bit, I guess, evolution of Book 1, what are some of the more modern improvements besides the quest logs?
Number one, I'd say we killed random battles because nobody likes random battles. Well, a few people do, but they're masochists.
Yeah, unless you're grinding Pokemon.
And that's the thing. We're Book 1, you know, it was very much 8-bit style, NES early RPG, where we kind of stayed true to what they were. And part of what they were very grindy, very painful at times.
Yeah.
And you kind of had to force your way through them. And that's what they were, so that's what we made. With this, we want a game that you can just play through. You should never have to feel like you need to grind. You should never be frustrated by what the game is doing for you. I mean, it's a lot of nice stuff. You know, the whole crafting system where you can either make items or actually take the items you have and upgrade them through crafting materials. We have the quest log. We have, well, similar to Book 1, but, you know, we have cross-save. So both PS3 and the Vita, if you buy it on either system, you own it for both.
Yeah.
And you can upload your game to the cloud and then download it on the other and pick up where you left off.
Yeah, that's going to be very handy. Like, I flew in to PAX from Chicago. I bought Book 1 on the PAX sale that they have on PSN. And, it's going to be great to be able to upload my progress.
Then if you want, when you get home, you can finish up where you were on the PS3.
Yeah.
And so we're continuing that. This is, like I said, cross-save, so save share games, cross-buy, so if you buy it for one, you get it for both. We're really just trying to give everyone every excuse they can have to own a Vita because it's such a great little system. And
yeah, it really is. It needs all the support. And the great thing about it, or one of my favorite things about the system, is that it's got all this great indie support.
It does. It is ridiculous how much Sony has done to get us behind it. And they've been awesome, and so we love working with them, so we're going to keep working with them. I mean, and the Vita is just such a fun system to work on just because it has a gorgeous screen and it has buttons, and as an indie these days, your options are the PC where it's keyboard and mouse mostly, or phones where it's touch screens. And I grew up, you know, I started playing games in the early 80s where I had buttons, and I've always preferred buttons.
Yeah.
So I love the Vita for that.
Yeah, someone carrying around like an old Game Boy Color in my pocket. I'm always appreciating the buttons, man. So, of course, Book 2, what's the scope of the Dragon Book series? Is this... was it always the series?
So, basically, the idea of this is long, long ago when me and Adam Rippon, who is the creative director slash writer on the game, when we were 14 years old, back in high school, we wanted to make a game like Chrono Trigger, and we thought we could actually do it. Despite not knowing how to make a game, not knowing how to program, and basically being, well, stupid teenagers. So, long, long ago, we wanted to do this. Fast forward a few years, we end up in the game industry. fast forward a few years past that, and suddenly I've started this company. And we're like, well, you know, after a while, it was just like, let's just finally make this game. So the original story had 9 different chapters. Dragon Fantasy Book 1 was the first 3 of those chapters. This game is 3 more chapters. So
okay.
There's the possibility that there will be a Book 3 if this does well enough. We're hoping that it does. If you're listening, please help it do well enough. My family wants to eat. But the real point is... I'm out of what now? Of those. I apologize.
That's fine.
Sorry, listeners.
We're on the show floor. It's fine.
Exactly. It happens.
Anything can happen.
Yeah. But so the idea is that, you know, so this is Book 2 in the series. We really made the game so that if you played Book 1, you'll get some of the in-jokes. If you haven't played it, you're not going to miss anything. The whole story is meant to be played as if you're approaching it fresh. You get reintroduced to all the characters. You get caught up on what's going on.
Yeah.
So that maybe you just don't like these super grindy old school RPGs. You don't want to play the first game. That you won't miss out on this game. We didn't want to require people to do that because some people just don't like them.
Yeah.
And we realize that. And we can't afford to cut our audience short.
But I mean, even with the grindy parts of the first game, I feel that like just the humor and the writing of it is you have to pull a lot of people through it if they don't enjoy that.
And that's the thing. Book 1 had, it was kind of got known in its little niche market for being very humorous. All the enemies have a lot of crazy flavor text. You have rock monsters that are in like a marital dispute, and their werewolf that when he dies is a cold, scared, naked guy. And, you know, so we kind of tried to bring a lot of life, because again, there wasn't a lot of animation in that game, so yeah. We tried to bring it to life through words. In Book 2, the storyline itself has kind of evolved and a lot more sophisticated and a bit more, I don't want to say grown up, but, you know, maybe a bit darker, a bit more serious. But we still have all the flavor text and, like, the crazy books that you can read in various towns. And, yes, there is a trophy for reading all the books. So, it's worth it. They're funny, or at least most of them are. And so we kind of want to make it, like, the game's a bit more serious than the main story, but it can still be fun and crazy. My 7-year-old son is one of the quest givers in the game, and if you decline his quest, he calls you a jerk.
Oh, man.
Because that's what a 7-year-old would do if you say no to them.
So, obviously, you have a very tight-knit group working on these games to the point where you have your kids in it.
Yes. Yeah, actually, all of our family members and most of the people who volunteered on the game and everything else, we're mostly located. We have a pirate village towards the beginning of the game. And so there's pirate versions of all of us in the game.
Nice.
Including our pets and, I believe, Kevin, who I'm pointing to. You can't see this because it's audio. His dog is in the game, I believe, and his kids are chasing each other around. And she's there. Not only with herself, but with a video game representation of herself from another video game in our video game.
And that's super Inception meta stuff.
Exactly. But we just kind of want to be able to have fun with it. And it's kind of our way of saying thank you to our families for tolerating this process of getting this game made.
So what does your kid think about being in the game?
He was so excited because we have a pirate rock monster in this game, and we have a giant plushie that every time he comes to my office, like, can I get one? And so his quest he gives you is to go hunt down and capture a pirate rock monster in the game.
That's great.
And so he just thought it was the coolest thing ever. I mean, how many 7-year-olds get to say, I'm in a video game?
Yeah. Like, the best we could do back in the day was, oh yeah, my uncle worked for Nintendo, and he didn't exist, or
exactly.
That uncle didn't exactly exist.
Exactly.
So, yeah, he's got a leg up, you know, at recess.
Exactly. That's the goal. That's the hope.
So, Book 1, though, I want to kind of go back, because just a little bit. How well did it do?
So, Book 1 was a bit weird, because it first launched a couple years ago on mobile.
Yeah.
And, It got a decent, I guess, reception on mobile for what lacks in hardcore core gaming demographic.
Yeah.
The people that loved it, and everyone else didn't know it existed or didn't know what a JRPG was. We tried to bring it out on PC and Mac, and everyone told us, oh, we don't care about mobile games.
Wow.
And then we started talking to Sony, and they were like, we love this, we want it. And so we just put out Book 1 earlier this year on PlayStation 3 and Vita, similar to Book 2. And the reception so far has been awesome. And, you know, the number of sales we've gotten have been obviously enough to warrant finishing the sequel. And, I mean, it's hard to say because what we consider good numbers, like, the bigger companies would, like, be jumping out of a window out over, but...
Yeah, like, it's so crazy that, like, an indie game can sell, like, sell 70 to 100,000 copies, and, you know, that'd be like, hey, that's great.
It's a huge success, we're rich!
And then meanwhile, you got Square Enix selling 3.5 million.
This game only 5 million copies, you're all fired.
Yeah, you've got the CEO at Square Enix throwing himself out of a bell tower.
And that's the thing, is that, you know, like I said, we're a small team, and we don't need a lot. We just need enough to make the next game.
Right.
That's the hope, is that we make enough off this one to make the next one.
Yeah, and that's just the best part, I think, about, you know, the whole indie culture. Just, you know, this whole indie mega booth here at PAX, which is a huge part of the show.
It's grown immensely since last year, too. It's from, I suppose you have to quote me on this because we're recording. From what I've heard, the indie mega booth put together is bigger than any other booth in the show.
I think so.
I believe we have surpassed Microsoft, Sony, and Nintendo.
Yeah, it's definitely bigger than Microsoft booth and Nintendo. Sony's got a kind of a whole thing going on, but yeah. Like, I mean, when I went to PAX East in 2012, it was like
12 little kiosks off to the side.
Yeah, it was still called a mega booth, but it was about 10 teams. And now there's 10 teams on this side, and then there's another 30 over there.
I don't recall how many different people there are, but I mean, looking at the map, there's what, 40, 50?
Yeah, it's insane. And
it's just blown up, and I mean, the indie mega booth people are awesome to work with, and they kind of do this for... So, here, I'll tell you something about the indie mega booth. Kelly Wallach, who runs the whole thing, kind of she organizes the whole thing and kind of keeps it going. She got so many submissions, she had to reject some people because there just wasn't a room. She personally wrote a separate email to every single person apologizing that they couldn't make it into the indie mega booth this time. It wasn't some big mass form. It was like, I am sorry we couldn't get you in.
Oh, man. That's just crazy to me.
But that's the other thing that's different. You look at the big AAA titles. How many people working at, you know, again, all the Square Enix, you brought them up. How many people of the higher-ups there are in gaming because they love games, and how many are there because it's money?
Exactly.
Everybody in this entire area is doing this. Believe me, we could all make a lot more money doing something else, but we're here because we love it, and we want to do this.
Yeah, there's probably more money in making, like, the next Sims 3 expansion, or whatever.
I could go make banking software or something.
Yeah. Like,
I'd be miserable, but I could do it.
I did Quicken Loans 2015. It's and I want to just not come into work ever again.
Yes. Indie developers are proof that money does not equal happiness.
Let's see, I think that's about all I've got, but
right.
When is this game coming out?
Alright, so like I said, Dragon Fantasy Book 1 came out earlier this year.
On sale on PSN.
On sale for the next 4 days, so if you happen to catch this before then, buy it. Dragon Fantasy Book 2 comes out September 10th. It is $14.99. If you're a PlayStation Plus member, it is 20% off for the first week.
That's $11.99?
I believe that's $11.99. And if you have a Vita and a PS3 and you're not a PlayStation Plus member, why? There is such a great deal. But really, either way, buy our game. Like I said, my kids want to eat. And I want to keep making games, so let me do it, please.
And we'd love to see those games, because these are great.
Well, thank you for stopping by.
All right, well, great talking to you.
All right, you too. Thank you.
So thanks again to Brian for sitting down to talk to me about Dragon Fantasy Book 2. Now we have an interview with one Ben Grew of Bed Bros Games, and he's currently working on a game called Sully, a very serious RPG. And with a name like that, you just know that it is indeed a comedy JRPG. And we talk about, of course, some of the design philosophies behind the title and the game's upcoming Kickstarter project. So take a listen to that. All right, and my name is Joe Garcia. I'm with StealthyBox.com. And who am I speaking with here?
I'm Ben McGraw, and I am the founder of Bread Brothers Games, breadbros.com.
Very good. And you just showed me a demo of Sully, a very serious RPG.
Sully, a very serious RPG.
And, of course, it's anything but...
Yeah. You know, when I say it's a very serious RPG, some people think I'm saying that as a second sentence. I'm working on Sully, period. A very serious RPG, period. Which, I didn't really see that one coming, but I was having a hard time finding a good title for it anyway.
So what does Sully refer to, though?
Oh, Sully is actually, Sully is the name of the clam, a talking magic clam that you that you meet early on. The scene that you saw, he had left the party temporarily to give the kids some privacy. But yeah, he's a He's kind of a jerk, actually. And the story isn't about him at all. But he's kind of the instigator and common thread of the story. It's a thing.
Yeah. It seems like a common JRPG trope, actually. Like, sometimes they'll just mention a thing, and it kind of, sort of, is part of the story. Like, I forget what the last game that I saw that did that, where it's like, there's something in the title, but you don't really see it or hear about it a whole lot.
Like, Final Fantasy wasn't a Final Fantasy.
Yeah.
No, the first one was. That's the
Yeah, story. Like, that was literally just their last-ditch effort.
Or Dragon Fantasy. There are no dragons in Dragon Fantasy Book 1. It's called Dragon Fantasy.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's any fantasizing either.
No, not really.
So I'm just going to call you guys out in a second.
And Dragon Fantasy, also a comedic kind of, like, take on a JRPG genre.
And friends of mine, actually, they helped me get onto PlayStation Mobile.
Oh, so you're going to be releasing solely on PSM, or...?
PlayStation Mobile, yeah. I'm a managed title on PlayStation Mobile, and it's also going to be coming out on PC, Mac, and Linux. We can talk more about that later.
Okay.
But those are the platforms currently announced.
Yeah, all right. And, of course... you take it a slightly different direction than, you know, the Dragon Fantasy guys. You don't quite do the fourth wall breaking thing.
I don't know if they do heavy fourth wall breaking.
No.
I was talking earlier when I showed you the game that I, you know, fourth wall breaking humor is perfectly fine. I think it can be used well, but it's not my style. I would rather do something more like the Venture Brothers, where they make a ridiculous world, and the inhabitants of the world just accept that that's the way it is, because that's the way it is. So, like, you know, in their world, there are boy adventurers and mad scientists and evil villains that hench the mad scientists,
yeah.
And that's great. You know, and in my world, there are ancient ruins and boy adventurers that go through them, and people that that learn magic and learn how to summon gods and stuff, but they have to go to work and get jobs, and money is an issue, and some of them go to college, and you know, it's not a big deal that some people are boy adventurers. It's just, you know, most common people think they're rich kids that are just touristy and destroying the natural resources of the world and stuff.
Yeah.
And they're kind of right.
So it's basically a world where, like, the innkeeper might also just happen to go out into the mountains and just fight stuff just because that's the way it is.
That could happen, I guess. I've got to go get some herbs and...
some herbs for, you know, for people that are resting up.
Right. So,
but I got to get them in this goblin-infested mountain.
I guess that could happen. It's nothing like that does in the game, but, I could conceive of that. I think I actually just think of the adventuring section of the population as kind of, you know, like living in kind of their own warped reality.
Yeah.
And the rest of the world it doesn't care and is like trying to ignore them and get on with their lives, you know.
Yeah.
It's like a niche subculture. It's like being in a specific music scene or something, you know.
Yeah. And visually, the game, like, the overall stuff is, you know, like, as you see with so many other indie, you know, RPGs, but once you get into the battle, the sprites and the pixel art, it's so detailed.
Yes. So we do have, a chunky pixel style, like, 16-bit era style of art for the maps,
yeah.
Like, where you go exploring and talking to people. It looks reminiscent of Phantasy Star 4 or Final Fantasy 6 or something like that. But in the battles, it does upgrade graphics.
Yeah,
the resolution does change, which the game developers often think is a big no-no in design. But there's this long-standing tradition in JRPGs, especially 2D JRPGs, that the battle system looks strikingly different from the map system.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this natural break with the transition between, like, map and battles. So like, because you have that natural break, I just capitalize on that, and you know, the curtains come down, and up comes something that's beautiful.
Right. And
full and well animated. It looks like I've been comparing it to Valkyrie Profile style sprites.
Nice.
Or for those of you not familiar with that, just maybe Capcom style fighting sprites.
Yeah, something like out of Marvel versus Capcom or something.
Well, I mean, that's more of a cartoon style, like with the, you know, kind of Disney cel shaded, I think. But like, Ours have more of a painterly aesthetic to them, which I think is really great. Brian Rathman, the artist, who also did the character animation on Dungeons of Dreadmoor, he did a really amazing job with this.
Yeah, it's really beautiful to look at. And music, too, you said it was done by...
Matthew Steele, who also did the Dungeons of Dreadmoor soundtrack. He's been making JRPG music with me for my JRPG games for about 17 years. I have made many small demos, small games, jam games in that time. I've learned a lot of lessons. I've been trying to make like big giant JRPGs for like since 1997, and like I did all the newbie mistakes, like I'm going to make a 10-part series that's going to be 80 hours long in the first one, and each one, the subsequent one's going to be 20 more hours.
And yeah, like Chrono Trigger, like oh, that game probably easy to make, right?
Oh my god, Chrono Trigger must have taken, you know, like 50 man years to make.
Yeah, no.
At least, probably much more.
That was pretty much like Square's like dream team of developers. So imagine, some kid like, oh yeah, I can make a game like that, right?
Right, right.
And of course, it's not so easy once you start actually get in there.
Right, right.
But so where exactly did what was the spark that told that you wanted to make Sully?
Well, like I said, I made RPGs about 17 years ago in this engine called Verge RPG. It's verge-rpg.com if you're interested in seeing the husk of the community. and there were, it was a very vibrant community. There were like 40,000 lurkers, but because I have access to the web blog, so I can see like how much activity there was. But like about 1,000 active people in the forums, and like for a couple of years in the late 90s, like every day there was another little JRPG demo, like a town and a dungeon and some puzzles and stuff, and it was really fun and exciting, and like it changed my life. It taught, like I basically self-taught to be a programmer there. And like later on, I actually took over the community when the founders just stopped caring, and I recoded the website in PHP and learned how to be a web programmer there. And like, you know, that paid the bills afterwards, and it changed everything about my life. But I really wanted to get back to making video games.
Ah, yes.
And when I saw my friends like over at Gaslamp Games come out with Dreadmoor, which I was involved with early on, but. And when I saw that be successful, and when I saw Zoboid Games come out with Breath of Death 7 in the beginning on XBLIG, that specifically looked like one of those little old RPGs, and I'm like, I want to do this now. I want to unburden my soul. I want to close that story of my life and ship one that like I can play on a console and people can play. It doesn't need to be like, oh, I want to do it, and I eventually quit my job, and we were doing that, and we originally were making it for XBLIG, and then Sony, Microsoft stopped really talking to the indies and supporting the indies, and Sony was all like, hey there, how you doing, indie community?
Right.
Well, we've got things over here.
Yeah, and they've actually done a good job with the PlayStation Mobile as well. Like you can not only play it, you know, on the PlayStation certified, you know, mobile like phones and tablets, but you can play the games on Vita as well. Mm-hmm. So like it's very accessible stuff, very fairly priced. So right. A lot of good stuff on there.
Yeah. A lot of people I see a lot of people that are kind of harsh on PSM right now, but you have to realize it's still very early days. We're still like within a year of its launch.
Yeah,
and like, I mean, XBLIG didn't really have any super huge like successes for a few years. I think I made a game with zombies, and it came out about a year or so in.
Yeah, and even still, that's still the game that people usually bring up first when talking about the XBLIG kind of.
Well, either that or any number of castle miners or Minecraft clones, or Minecraft clones with zombies in it.
Yeah.
That was Castle Miner Z, I think.
Let's
see. Okay. Minecraft sells and zombies sell. I've got an idea.
Yeah.
This is a pretty smart idea, actually.
So what made you take like the more comedic route with Sully?
Well, this is actually a reboot of that Verge Engine's original demonstration game, which was called The Sully Chronicles. Fun fact: that game was the only like non-publisher game to be on GameFAQs.com for like 15 years or so.
Really?
Yeah, because Cal Magura, who did the famous Final Fantasy VII fact, like the Final Fantasy VII fact that basically made GameFAQs what it was made by Cal Magura, and he had a lot of leverage there, and he also was in the Verge community. Actually, Robert Boyd, that makes the Void games, is also in the Verge community. Also, Nicholas Vining, who did Dungeons & Dread Wars in the Verge community. Also, no, stop.
No, keep going, man.
The community gave birth to a lot of different artists and programmers that and musicians, actually, that have gone to be industry people. It was the easiest thing to find to make video games in 97 when you were on Yahoo because there was no Google. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, some people are surprised when we find all the connections in these early internet day communities, but why would you be surprised? You were searching for things that you were interested in, met people that were in with the same interests.
Yeah.
It just follows that they would all do similar-ish things.
Of course. So, who else is helping besides, you've got the pixel artist, you've got the artist, you've got the composer, there's you, is there anybody else?
Oh yeah, it's a team of 10 to 12, mostly contractors and people like me who are basically not getting paid and working for RevShare.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, debt is a fun thing.
Yeah.
And we're actually a little constrained on budget right now, and we're considering doing a Kickstarter in the next few weeks, basically to make sure that I can afford to pay the artists to complete the game to its full glory. Like, we can... We have asset complete for static images in the battle system, but I don't want them to be static.
Yeah.
I don't want the battles to be just like Final Fantasy VI style pretty picture that doesn't move.
Yeah.
Like you saw that.
Yeah.
Everything was moving, there were different animations.
Yeah, they seem to be a lot of frames in the animations as well.
A lot of frames means a lot of work.
Yeah.
And like a lot of work from artists that like their entire livelihood is making their art. So I have to, in good faith, pay them, like cash to sustain them.
Yeah.
And like it's their job, and I'm looking to like to kickstart so I can like make sure that they stay in eating bread and not getting kicked out of houses.
Yeah.
And also release in a realistic time frame, because this game is getting shipped no matter what. It's going to be shipped in a good state. I just want to make sure it gets shipped in the state I want it to be in.
That's great.
Yeah.
Anything else that you wanted to...
We're taking pre-orders right now. The pre-orders and any... So we're taking pre-orders now. And if you pre-order now, that's only for the PC, Mac, and Linux versions. PlayStation Mobile doesn't have
right.
As far as I know, it.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. We're taking pre-orders now for $9.99, which is $5 off the retail price. And if you pre-order before the Kickstarter launches, we'll kick you up a tier, so you get you're paying less for more.
There you go.
You'll get the $15 tier, which includes the soundtrack. So,
which is very good.
Well, thank you, thank you. I happen to think so. Fans of JRPGs love it. I would say it's heavily inspired by Mitsuha. So the Chrono Trigger soundtrack.
Nice.
Matt Steele really, really loves Mitsuha. But we also bring a lot of different elements in. So it's got. It's JRPG orchestral instruments, if you're interested in that, with highlights in like the Commodore 64 chipset.
Ah.
And I think the Sega Genesis chipset. You'll have to ask him.
Okay.
But it's got a little bit of chiptune and a lot of like maybe like late SNES, early PlayStation era RPG music habit thingies.
All right.
That's a technical term as well.
Yeah, a lot of technical terms.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think that's pretty much all I have.
Okay, no other question? No, I mean... I didn't tell you about the battle system.
Oh, of course.
I really didn't tell you about anything about the. So I'm an adult. You yourself were saying that you only play really one JRPG a year?
Yeah, like I buy one and just really dive into it.
Right.
Yeah, last year was Persona 4. I have Nino Kuni sitting for me at home for once I, you know, get through, you know, the holiday rush or whatever.
Right, right. My one RPG this year, or at least, I've been playing, some ideas right now, hold on. Radiant Historia recently. I'm taking time off from dev, mind you, I've been like nonstop at this for months now, and I'm a little harried.
Yeah.
I'm taking a 2 days off to like play and beat Dragon Fantasy Book 2 when it comes out,
yeah.
Because those guys are great.
Yeah.
Check it out. It's on the Vita. It's going to be out September 8th, 9th?
10th.
10th. Okay, well, I'm obviously not their PR. We don't play that many JRPGs, though, because they tend to be really long, and there's
right.
a lot of grind in them, and you have to do a lot of commitment.
Yeah.
You don't want to get into that situation where you save, you come back to it in a month, and you're like, what am I doing again?
Yeah, like, I played Persona 4, took 100 hours to beat, and I thought I wasn't... Like, I didn't think I was taking my time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big game.
So, I like exploration in JRPGs, and I like side quests and like just going around towns and actually interacting with the townsfolk and doing things that change over time, and that's actually a large part of why this takes so long, and why, you know, the reason that the fact that it takes so long is why you don't see this very much these elements very much in indie JRPGs right now, you especially are discouraged from doing exploration in dungeons when there's random battles.
Yeah.
There aren't random battles in my game.
That's great.
Every battle is visible on the map. There's sprites on the map, and there's a cutscene right before it happens. And you can avoid some of the battles, and some you can't, because they're at choke points, you know.
Yeah.
These little vignettes can go from, like, remember in Chrono Trigger when you had the two goblins kicking the roly-poly and
yeah.
then they attack you? There's that kind of, like, not like just physical aspect of it. Or there's, like, actually talking beforehand. Yes.
Yeah.
But you get little rewards before and after.
Yeah, and there's a lot of talking even in the battles.
Well, not a lot, but, like...
Not a lot, but...
The battle you saw, the mighty and invincible Lord Stan taunted you via text boxes. Lord Stan, Prince of Heck.
Oh, Prince of Heck.
Dark Prince of Heck. not that other guy from that other place. Stan Heck, not other. That other guy has better PR. Anyway, where was I? Every dungeon, you're not going to get penalized for walking around and, like, exploring and taking your time to, like, chew the scenery and whatnot, because there aren't random battles. Unless you want there to be, because there's at the beginning of every dungeon and near the boss of every dungeon, there is this thing called a heck mouth. The heck mouth, you just talk to it and you get into a random battle.
Oh, okay.
So it's opt-in random battles.
No, that's interesting.
Or summonable battles. Oh man, there's... That was annoying.
Apparently a ship is pulling into port.
The world's giantest Vesuvula. So there's that. Then there's another mode where you can turn off all battles.
It's like, all together?
All together. It, like, everything, because there's a lot of, like, interactive story elements with the setup and conclusion of the battles, you just see it Earthbound style, where, like, the battle itself is replaced with a little ching-ching sound effect and, like, a flash. The third, which has been getting surprising amount of thumbs-ups from people here at PAX, I've been randomly approached by, like, five people, like, that had heard about it. The third is the Shadow of Colossus-esque boss battle only mode.
Nice.
It's a little self-aggrandizing to call it Shadow of Colossus-esque, though. I mean, you just fight boss battles, you skip all the other ones, and you auto-level to where the boss battle should be. And, like... If you want to grind, if it's too hard, you don't lose the game. You just get booted out, and you can try again. And if at that case, you can go back to the heck mouth and grind if you want, or if you just want to give up, you can turn off the battles.
Wow.
So, like, the reason here is some people love just the story, you know. They put their favorite part of JRPG's story, so let them turn it off. Some people like fighting, but they're really, really busy and don't want to spend, you know, 20 hours playing your entire game.
Right.
So give them just the boss battles, which are, like, you know, the most fun. Although I'm really fond of, like, a lot of our non-boss battles, because they are all scripted, so yeah. They're just... It's got a lot of mini-boss flavor through the entire game. You know, so for very busy adults, do that. Yeah. And if you have a lot of time and just want to, like, experience a gorgeous, fun battle system, please, by all means, keep the battles on and grind to your heart's content.
And about the battles, too, I forgot to bring it up, but you brought it up. Because now the way it works is that, you know, of course you got your magic points, but instead of just spending them, you can gain them through regular battle.
That's correct. So magic users start with a small amount of magic points, and non-magic users start with 0 magic points, but non-magic users meaning magical swordsman type people.
Right.
That's still magic. Shh, don't talk. There are several skills that every character has that are magic points positive. They add magic to you. And then all the magic spells themselves cost magic points. So this is our metering system. That's part of the strategy of the game. Like, you're trying to pump up your magic points and using some certain skills, and then build up for like a big strike or protection or, you know, things like that.
So the points reset before every battle.
HP and MP reset after every battle. You come back to life after every battle. There's a status gets cleared after every battle. It's a very forgiving game. I don't believe in penalizing a player for dying, because, like, how many times in your life have you gone through the world's most annoying section of the game,
right.
and then
you're poisoned with 10 HP.
Yeah.
And you still have like a whole area to get through before you get to the next town.
Yeah, like, status ailments like that definitely hurt you. But if you die and you are reset all your gold and your experience points, that pisses you off.
It does.
It makes you want to stop playing the game, and people stop playing the game. I don't want people to stop playing the game. I want them to finish it. Also, there's no save points. You can save anywhere.
That's good.
So it's a very forgiving system.
Yeah.
Because, like, I want you to enjoy the experience. Like, JRPGs aren't... To me, they're not strictly about, like, Iron Manning or proving yourself better than someone. It's a very interactive story.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think about them in movie terms. I think about them as stage plays, actually. Because, like, you're usually viewing them, especially 2D RPGs, you're viewing them from a distance, so you don't really get to see their full expression and all that.
Yeah.
So, like, that's exactly like watching, like, Hamlet.
Right.
Not that I'm comparing myself to Hamlet. No,
so
I actually
got Shadow of the Colossus. We got Hamlet.
I am the Hamlet of Shadow of the Colossus of JRPGs. Anyway, also there are interactive elements to the battle, like Super Mario RPG style timed strikes,
yes,
and button mashing sequences and stuff like that. I originally did want to do more, but we had to truncate some of the features, We will possibly be, if we kickstart so we have more money, we'll have more resources to do that, and those can go back in. I would like to do that. I cut a branch of the storyline and just trimmed it down to reel it in. This is something that happens all the time in game development. I'd love to put it back, though.
Maybe it could be a stretch goal.
Yeah, exactly. It is. And also a stretch goal is to put the airship wander period back in. But that's going to be a really big stretch goal, because to fully do like a truly wonderful Final Fantasy VI style... you explore. There's a lot of things going on. There's a lot of interconnected threads. That is actually adding months of development to my time.
Yeah.
And I also have to stop. I've run myself into debt actually making this game. I currently am. I don't want to talk numbers. It's many thousands of dollars. Too many thousands of dollars. So the game is definitely shipping. It's. There's no way this game is not shipping. It's like for some fallback positions, it's already content complete. Map scripting is moving along perfectly. Digital content complete.
Yeah.
But I would like to push the bar as far forward as I could.
The best game it could be.
Yes, yes. The best big game could be the make daddy proud type thing with my chest pushed out and. Yeah. Is there anything else about the battles? I guess. One Sully, who's Sully the Clam, is one of eight seafood helpers you get during the game. One of them is always following your party around because you equip them in the seafood menu.
Of course.
And they show up in the battles as non-controllable PCs. And it's kind of like the Lufia 2 capsule monster thing, where the capsule monster did specific actions that they themselves had, or like Nahl or Ruby from Lunar, where like they did like little minor effects. But it's going to be more useful than Nahl and Ruby. They usually did like a little bit of healing or did one damage.
Yeah.
So like, for instance, you would use different as you collect the seafood characters. They do different things. So for instance, Sully, because he's a clam, will put shell on you. He'll like protect you. And because he's a jerk, he'll sometimes snap at the enemies. And Sancho, the sad octopus, because he's an octopus, will blind your enemies with ink sometimes. And because he's sad octopus, he will sometimes depress your enemies with his sadness.
What does depression do on the enemies?
Yeah. He's what?
I said, what does the depression effect do to the enemies?
It's a combination armor down and speed down, lower on both of those things, but not as much that as any dedicated like debuff would be.
Oh, okay.
So,
all right.
The website is breadbros.com.
And that's where people can pre-order the game now.
Pre-order the game now. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at Bengrue, Bengrue, for announcements about the Kickstarter. And also, Adam Rippon. So many variations. Adam Rippon of Dragon Fantasy and I are going to be doing a series of video podcasts teaching people about how to efficiently make a JRPG. It's going to be 5-minute or less episodes about very specific things. So it's punchy. We'll tell you about lessons learned, common pitfalls, things to avoid, things to do, and the business side of running things, because it is... There's a lot to think about, actually. And this podcast is going to be called The Adventure Capitalists. And I believe we're going to be hosted... we should finalize that first. It's going to be on a gaming media site. But follow me on Twitter, at Bengrue. And if you're interested in that as a fan or a creator, please, I'll be announcing where to go for that after in a few weeks.
All right, great. All right, Ben, well, that was great. Mm-hmm. And we'll be looking forward to the Kickstarter soon.
Thank you. And the game.
And the game, of course. So many thanks to go out to Ben for the lengthy but very worthwhile and in-depth interview. Now we have an interview with Simon Darvaux, co-founder of Spearhead Games, and he sat down and talked to me about the upcoming PS4 launch title, Tiny Brains, a cooperative/competitive puzzle platform party game-ish. He's a little bit better at describing what it actually is than I am, but rest assured that it is very fun. So without further ado, here is Simon.
So I'm Joe Garcia with StealthyBox.com, and who am I speaking to?
I am Simon Darvaux. I am producer on Tiny Brains and co-founder of Spearhead Games.
All right, and we just had a demo. It is a four-player cooperative game and also competitive in some challenge modes, but the co-op mode that I just played... very fun. It's describing the game, I guess it would be something like, well, I guess you get four different lab animals. They all have different powers. They're being experimented on.
Yeah. So basically, in Tiny Brains, you play as lab animals that were experimented on so much that they develop superpowers. So it's somehow the miniature version of the classic superhero story. So you can play as a hamster, a rabbit, a mouse, or a bat. And there is also other character, but I cannot speak too much about.
Ah, okay.
And each of them has developed a physics-based superpower. So the bat can force push like a Jedi. The hamster can create blocks out of thin air. The mouse can swap position with an object, so we call it teleport, and the green rabbit can attract, so it's a force pull power. So since it's a co-op puzzler, you need to combine those different abilities to solve the challenges.
And so how long have you guys been working on this game?
So we have started to think about it like maybe 2 years ago or something, but we kind of started the studio and built the team and started working in Unreal on mid-October, so it's been 10 months. Mid-October we had nothing. We didn't even have a local. We didn't have like room to work.
Oh, okay.
So we went from... So actually, I kind of resigned from Ubisoft. So I am a Ubisoft guy.
Yeah.
I worked on Assassin's Creed 2 Brotherhood, and I was also design director on the naval battle in Assassin's Creed 3. And I resigned on September 14th, took the plane. And it was an insane decision because I was kind of tormented, like, because I was kind of... Ubisoft is a great company to work at, and I was kind of in a good position.
Yeah.
But still, I felt like there was this indie revolution coming, and there was something happening now.
Yeah.
And this was the moment to do that now. I felt like if I don't do it now, while everything is starting and everything is happening, then I will never have the courage to do that ever. I felt it was kind of now or never kind of thing. So in September 14th, I went to my friend's house. I was sleeping in his office, and we were just discussing like this idea and like trying to see how it could fit and who could we work with and who would we recruit. And like, so it was like kind of 1 month later, so it was like 11 months ago, right?
Yeah.
So we went from this, me sleeping in his office, to now we have our local, the production is almost finished, and we have deals with Sony and stuff.
Yeah.
So I feel like this was just an incredible adventure. Honestly, I think I just don't even realize that I have now my own studio. You see what I mean? I was kind of... So in September last year, we were meeting people in Malik's living room, promising them that we would have a local in less than a month, that our game would work, like we were pitching our thing.
To publishers?
Yeah. No, to people. No,
or,
we were trying to
get people to
form the team.
Okay.
Yeah. And now it's already like there's 2 weeks to go, and we are on the finaling, and it's almost done, and it works, and it's a complete game. So for me, I think I just don't realize all the things that I've been going on, and how fast this thing has all happened.
Yeah, I mean, so it's not just you; it's also other veterans from other large publishers as well. I think someone from EA is also co-founder of the of Spearhead Games.
Yeah, so Malik and Atoll, the two other partners, come from EA, and we have other developers from a different studio. We have guys from Idols. The thing is, nowadays it's not that hard to find people who are passionate about video games and who are tired about somehow the big studio and how they do game, and they just want to like do what they are passionate for, which is game creation, right?
Right.
And sometimes the big publisher don't really allow that this much. So right now it's kind of super easy to find top notch, like high class developer that just want to do what they always dream to do, right?
Right.
Right. What they decided they wanted to do when they were kids. This is like really creating game and not just like doing this one thing and as part of a big chain, right?
Yeah.
So right now it's just super easy to find like a all-star team and form it. Like it took us like, I would say, 3 to 4 weeks to form our core team, and then we built from it.
Yeah, and that freedom allows you to come up with a very unique design philosophy, correct? It's not you guys don't work with the design documents or something.
You read about that, right?
Yeah.
So yes, we don't have a single paper design document, because I feel like creating a design document is somehow a political process where, okay, first of all, I think that human beings are not able to imagine gameplay until it exists.
You cannot
figure if it's cool or not, or even what it looks like, right? Unless it's, let's do the shooting of Call of Duty, or let's do the driving, you see what I mean? But if it does not exist yet, and for me, writing the the design document in forms of text is as ridiculous as trying to describe a song in form of text or describe a painting.
Yeah.
Imagine you want to prototype a painting. You don't like describe in with text what it will look like, right? You kind of make a sketch and like try to figure the color a bit. Doing prototype in text for gameplay is as ridiculous. It does not make sense, and still it triggers like this political process where everyone start discussing about it, and like 2 weeks after somehow you get a consensus based on the lowest common denominator where everyone agrees.
Yeah.
And then you start working on it and you try to make something work and realize it's not meant to work. 90% of the time it cannot even work, and you're shackled by this thing because otherwise you put to the garbage this whole process, right? So this is not how we work. How we work is if you have an idea of something that can work in the game, you just go in the engine and you do it. And if it was meant to work and if it looks fun and if it looks promising, everyone instantly jumps in. And if it's not fun, then we just flush it and it's just like dropping one half day of work and we don't care, right?
No, yeah. Sure.
So this allows us to really focus on our efforts on what works, what is fun for real, and all the coolness that is actually cool, even if it would not sound good on paper, right? We can focus on it, and all the stuff that would have looked good on paper but is not cool,
right,
and that is not meant to work, we just drop it. So we are very playtest driven. Basically, we invite people every single week, and for the last 3 months, twice a week, and we watch them play, and until we just regroup the entire team around them. And if they are not having fun, we don't pretend that they are having fun. We just hit it until it becomes fun, or we drop it. So it allows us to really always focus on making stuff objectively fun, not just like no, but they don't understand my vision. And if they understood like what I meant, or well, no, are they having fun? Yes, no. Okay, let's rework that. Yes, okay, cool. Let's see what I mean. So
yeah.
So it allows us to always focus on what works and what people likes.
Yeah, the way that seems to work at like a big publisher is that they'll focus test like something to death, and they basically end up with something super generic, trying to please everyone all the time, and that's usually not the best result or the best process, it seems.
But the thing is, with the typical planning, you kind of forecast the entire thing, and you kind of, how to say, you command the assets, so you call the animation, the sounds, and that, and then it's not possible to have an idea of what it looks like until everything comes together, right?
Yeah.
And then if it's not fun, then it's not fun, and you see what I mean?
You don't have any.
So we don't ask for any asset until we have figured the fun. We hit our prototype, even if it's an extra abstract form of it, until it's fun, and then we start building the asset around it and we see how it goes. But we never like, we are never in a situation where it will be fun when everything comes together.
Yeah, if it's not fun from pretty much seeing where you are right there, you just kind of don't even bother building on it, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So if it's not fun, then the thing is, if it's fun, you will make it look even better if you build around it, right?
Yeah.
Whereas if it's not fun, it won't become fun by building everything.
Yeah, by putting all the right lighting on it.
Yeah, exactly. So this is why we really focus on the gameplay first. And that's the thing, we kind of build these four power that are super, that have a lot of synergy between them. And we worked very hard on them for like 4 or 5 months until they are super solid. And now we realize that there are all sorts of gameplay that we can just start unfolding around this, right?
Yeah.
Instead of doing a lot of small type of gameplay, we did four features, force push, force pull, teleport, and block, but we did them super well and super tight, and now we can make like this two thing. There's also, have you seen the competitive mode?
Was it the soccer?
Yeah, the soccer, so we can build a soccer, we can make systemic combat challenge, we can just start unfolding all these things, right?
Yeah.
And it's always based on the core, so any player who plays any of these game modes will learn about every other game mode, and so I feel like it's a very it's a very needed evolution of the party genre, if you will. Instead of doing small games, we do a strong game and we build a grand challenge based on that.
Yeah, that didn't really strike me. I mean, I obviously had a lot of fun playing with my co-op partners here at the booth. And, yeah, like, I haven't had that much fun with a bunch of strangers playing a game in a long time. So
yeah, that's the thing. We wanted for us to measure if we were successful or not in creating... Because we felt that most of the co-op games are not really co-op, right? You are working together,
yeah.
But you don't really care what the other guys are doing, and you're not really... taking in account direction. Well, very often you're just fighting the same enemies, but that's it, right?
Right.
So for us to succeed, we needed to see that people speak to each other as they play.
Yeah.
And as long as we don't reach levels where people would start speaking, and that's the thing we realized, somehow we managed to create a game that even if you put strangers together that don't know each other,
yeah,
they will be shy and they will hesitate for a while, yeah. But you cannot succeed if you don't speak. So
right. So that's pretty much exactly what happened here. Like, I didn't know anybody there. I don't know if, how well they knew each other. But at the very first time we tried that cylinder challenge, we fell pretty much immediately, about 200 meters in.
Yeah.
But then our second
centimeters.
Run, yeah. And then on the second round, the second try, we're like, all right, we started talking to each other. Like, you push while I... swapped positions with the ball, and next thing you know, we got, well, wasn't as impressive as the high score, but we got well over 1,000 centimeters.
Yeah,
and
we're very proud, because we feel it's something that was never really achieved before.
Yeah.
And you have to coordinate and, like, somehow start working with a strategy as a single machine, right?
Yeah.
And you really have to be part of this thing and to synergize, otherwise it will never work. And we feel like there's right now not many game, or I never seen other game that succeed as well on that.
And out of all the challenge modes, which one do you find people respond the best to? Which one's your favorite? Right. Which is your personal favorite, and what seems to be the crowd favorite here?
You mean in the demo? Or?
Yeah, the demo, the challenges.
Between the rolling tube and the tiny sucker, it's very tight. I think my personal favorite would be the rolling tube.
Yeah.
But here at PAX, the tiny sucker just generates so much people screaming, and the competitive aspect adds a lot of emotion to it. But the cool thing with the systemic tube is this is the first systemic challenge we built. It was our first systemic thing. It was built like in May. And I've played like almost every day since that, and I'm not tired of this game. I'm still a freaking addict. I keep testing it all the time. It just never becomes old. So, and we have another one that I think is even more fun than the ruling two, but we don't have it in the demo.
And how many challenge modes or how many challenge games do you guys have in total? Can you disclose that?
So we have 4 systemic ball maps. Like the rolling tube,
yeah.
1 systemic fight, 5 puzzle time attack, and we have tiny sucker, and we have 2 other modes that are not yet announced.
And all of that on top of the, I guess, the, you can call it the story or campaign mode?
We call it tiny story.
Tiny story.
Tiny story, tiny challenge, tiny sucker.
Nah, okay. So the game is coming, it's a PlayStation 4 launch title. It's also becoming on PlayStation 3 as well.
Yeah, PS4, PS3, Steam, and hopefully Xbox, but I cannot announce it officially because we did not sign anything. So.
Okay. Alright, so I guess everybody can finally get their hands on it soon. What is this? We're in August, so a couple months away from everybody being able to get their hands on this.
And hopefully we're very anxious. It's our first game, but I think that we have somehow a good formula, because, like I told you, we play test more than 50 times. We tried with super hardcore pro gamer. We tried with kids of 5 years and even casual or non-gamer, and with old people of 60 years. And we never found a single person who does not like it and doesn't find it fun in this formula. Because the campaign really pleased, like, everyone, including even the hardcore gamer loved the campaign as well.
Yeah, it's hard to be cynical about a game like this.
To be cynical?
Yeah, you can't be cynical around a game like that. It's just like, even like their little crowds gathering as waiting for their turn, and they're just watching and they're cheering it and hooting and hollering along with the people playing.
Yeah, exactly. So playing the campaign alone is not doable by casual, but as soon as there is one hardcore gamer or one gamer in the group, like even the 5-year-old kid can be part of a group that finishes the game. So
yeah.
So we're super proud. I don't know how it will work, because the thing is, it's a bit hard to market it because it's not a visual breakthrough technically, you see what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think that the fun factor of it is very high, so we just are hoping for the best.
Alright. Alright, well, thank you so much for your time. I'm not going to hold you too much longer. I'm pretty sure there are more eager gamers over waiting at the Tiny Brains booth.
Yeah, I must take care of the
rescue. Yeah, so thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for coming, it was a pleasure.
So many thanks again to the people at Spearhead Games for setting up that appointment and interview. Looking forward to that title a lot. Now we have an interview with someone that really needs no introduction, at least not to video game music fans. It's Tommy Tallarico, co-founder and creator and CEO of Video Games Live, also very, very lengthy history of composing very high quality and iconic video game music over the years. You may know him from games like Earthworm Jim, Cool Spot, literally a bunch of games that it's way too many to list, but rest assured that the man knows what he's doing. And we talked to him about a Kickstarter project that he's setting up, or that is already currently running, for an album in the Video Games Live lineage. So, yes, why am I even still talking? Here's Tommy Tallarico. Alright, so my name is Joe Garcia with StealthyBox.com, and the man I'm interviewing really doesn't need any introduction. Should be introducing me, but for those who don't know, this is Tommy Tallarico, famed music composer for many years, and now the host and creator and executive. What's the executive position at Video Games Live?
Executive producer, I guess. I don't know.
All right.
Whatever you want. Just make some crap up. I don't care.
And we're here to talk about a Kickstarter for Video Games Live.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've been, I've been doing Video Games Live for 11 years, and I've come out with two albums, and we did a big PBS special in 2010 as well. And with Video Games Live, I put all of the money right back into the show. So, you know, I don't take a salary. It's all the money goes right back in. And every, 4 or 5 years, we save up enough money to put out an album. Because, you know, my whole reason for creating Video Games Live is I wanted to prove to the world how culturally significant and artistic video games have become. And so I want to create as much content, get as much, amazing, high-quality content out there as I can. And so when we did our PBS special, we self-funded, all these things. So the PBS special, for example, is, $750,000. It took us 10 years to, kind of come up with that kind of money. And so now that, Kickstarter is up and around, we thought it'd be a great opportunity to put out even more material and kind of fast track putting out albums and things like that. But the other cool thing about it is that, it's not just that you're funding our third album, but I want to use this as an opportunity and an excuse to put as much video game music in the hands of people as I can. So one of the things we're doing with the Kickstarter is whatever you pledge, we at least give you quadruple value back in rewards. At least quadruple value. So like people who are putting even at the very lowest levels, like $5, $10, people are getting hours of high recorded video game music, from video game composers all over the world. And then, like levels like the $25 level, you're getting $125 worth of stuff. I mean, we even have this crazy, crazy level where we're giving you like 12 video game albums, so it's really nuts. And so that's always been our goal, is to, put as much music in the hands of the fans as possible. And the other reason too is that, record companies don't believe in video game music and don't think that video gamers are willing to pay for it. They feel, they're just going to steal it anyway, so why should we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars recording big symphonies and just when people are going to just either steal it off the internet or download it on YouTube or whatever. So we don't think that's the case. We think that, like putting out a quality product, people are excited about it, and that's what, we're showing in the Kickstarter. So we're about halfway through the campaign, and we got about half the money raised. So, hopefully, we can see it through.
Yeah. And Video Games Live, you said it's been over 10 years. I believe a couple of years ago you guys played your 200th show.
Yeah, we're
at E3.
Yeah, yeah, we're about to do our 300th show. Yeah, but yeah, it's,
wow,
it's
so
crazy. It's yeah, we're in the Guinness Book of World Record actually as the biggest video game concert and the game concert that's played the most shows in the world. So yeah, it's kind of nuts.
Yeah.
50 shows a year all over the world, from Dubai to China to Scotland and Ireland to New Zealand and Chile and Brazil. We're all over the place.
That's amazing stuff. I mean, and looking at the reception every time you guys go somewhere, it's insane.
I think it says a lot about the video game industry, you know, when you can go to places like Taiwan and Singapore and Malaysia and places like Poland and Portugal and Spain and places like Argentina and Peru, and you know, tens of thousands of people are, you know, participating in a celebration of video games. You know, it's an amazing thing.
What's the biggest venue you guys have played?
We've played to 100,000 people in Taiwan before.
Holy cow.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy.
So I guess I should ask, what, I mean, for some people who might not be like familiar with the Video Games Live, can you explain a little bit about what kind of instrumentation you guys use, the arrangement, I guess. Like.
Yeah, well, Video Games Live, it's all the greatest video game music of all time played by a full symphony and choir. But what makes it really special and unique is that everything's completely synchronized to massive video screens, rock and roll lighting, special effects, a stage show production, interactive elements with the crowd. So I always kind of like to describe it as having all the power and emotion of a symphony orchestra, but combined with the energy and excitement of a rock concert, mixed together with all the cutting-edge visuals and technology and interactivity and fun that video games provide. And so, you know, all the traditional symphonic instruments are there, you know, strings and horns and woodwinds and timpanis and percussion and harps and pianos. But then we also add a big, you know, kind of element of like electronics and, you know, electronics and drum loops and I play guitar, so there's rock and acoustic guitar in some of the songs, and you know, big rock drums and bass, and so it really depends on the song. You know, if we're doing like a Final Fantasy thing, it's more of a traditional symphonic thing. But if you're doing like Halo or Metal Gear Solid or Castlevania, even, you know, we want to kind of rock it out a little bit and add you know, bring it up a few notches. So yeah, it's kind of everything, every instrument.
And how do you guys decide exactly what to play? Like, I mean, obviously, yeah, you know, there's all this great classic music, and then there's always new, awesome stuff coming from the...
It's always a balance, right? So we always try to play a balance of old and new, and so I've created over 120 segments for Video Games Live over the last 10 years, and we can only play about 18 of them a night. So you can imagine, you know, we've been going down to places like Brazil for 9 years, and we've never played the same show twice. So... And the way we create music is, you know, I mean, there's such an endless well of video game music, so we draw from, you know, what's already out there, new games that are coming out. But also we ask people on Facebook and our mailing list. In fact, whenever we do a show, we create an events page on Facebook, and we ask people what they want to hear, and that's how we come up with a set list, by, you know, by having people tell us what they... I mean, the show's for them, for the audience, not me,
right.
You know? So I kind of, like, take what they want, and I tally it all up, and I create the set list based around what people want. And then people always ask us to put new stuff in the show, whether it's, you know, some of the stuff we're working on now, or things like Devil May Cry, and Earthbound, and the Mana series, and you know, so many different things from Mario and Zelda and Final Fantasy as well. So always putting it in. In fact, we just did a Monkey Island segment that we did we released in Comic-Con, and that's going to be on our album. And yeah, a lot of fans kept asking Monkey Island, so we put it together.
And going back to the album a little bit, how big is, what's the scope of the album?
Yeah, so we want to do about, you know, 15 to 20 tracks. We want, you know, some of the stuff, we announced Monkey Island, some of the stuff, and it's going to have all the original LucasArts composers playing on it and performing on it. In fact, we give a sample of it on our Kickstarter page. You can hear it and listen to it, the mock-up of what it's going to sound like. And the LucasArts guys are playing on the mock-up as well. And about, you know, things like Shadow of the Colossus and Beyond Good and Evil and Journey and Diablo 3 and some deep Halo, Warcraft cuts and Skyrim and Earthworm Jim, you know, some of the stuff that you typically wouldn't never hear on a video game compilation. Right. You know, things like Beyond Good and Evil and Shadow of the Colossus and Monkey Island. But, you know, this is our third album now, and we really want to, you know, these are some of the fan favorites, though. Chrono Cross, Chrono Trigger, you know. And so we really want to, the fans are helping to fund this, and we want to, you know, give the fans, you know, the fan favorites over the years of, you know, kind of the hardcore stuff.
So, and now we're walking around PAX, we're not walking right now, but PAX here.
People don't know that. We could be running really quick.
We're actually in a car on the freeway.
Exactly. We're driving through PAX.
And so, I mean, seeing some of the stuff around here, like, are you kind of gathering ideas in terms of musically? Maybe, like...
Oh, yeah, no, I was just talking right before this interview. I was just talking to the composer of Bastion. And we get a lot of requests for that. And, we put stuff in the show that were games that aren't even out yet. You know, this summer we were doing Dota 2 and Diablo 3 before the new games that had even come out. We're doing Assassin's Creed 4 in the show already, not out yet. We're doing Destiny, Bungie's next big game, written by the guys who did Halo and Paul McCartney. And we're doing that now. We started playing that in July, and the game isn't even coming out till 2014. So, yeah, we're always looking, for new stuff, and for sure.
So that's interesting then. So, I mean, people go to these concerts and they're hearing stuff for the first time sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of times. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, so, I mean, when you do something like that, I mean, does the composer play along with you? Is he at the show?
When we did Destiny at Comic-Con this year, and it's actually, you can view it on Twitch TV, because we did a whole live stream. 300,000 people were watching it live.
Oh, man.
We had the composer, Marty O'Donnell, was conducting the symphony. Same thing with Dota. Tim Larkin, the composer, was conducting the symphony. When we did our Monkey Island segment, the original LucasArts guys came down and they were playing guitar and bass on the track. So, yeah, absolutely. You know, and that's what the album is. The album, we want to have game composers from all around the world take part and perform on this album with us.
It really is the best celebration of what is usually like a really underappreciated segment of like video games.
Exactly.
You know, people are always like, oh, the gameplay this, the multiplayer that.
Yeah.
And sometimes they'll even just play like music or podcasts over the music and
right.
the sound.
Yeah.
And it drives me crazy. Like, I actually talked to someone like last week on my podcast, and they're like, sometimes I'll just throw it on. And I was like, why would you do that? To like, like, what? Like, to me, it's like a cardinal sin. So, I mean, stuff like video games live. And you know, so you'll see, you know, Final Fantasy guys touring. You'll see, you know,
Zelda
guys.
Is,
And I think that's amazing stuff. And it's crazy to me that that labels don't recognize that this is a thing, a real thing that people love and support.
That's right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you're helping to support us too.
All right.
By spreading the word for us.
All right, Tommy. So I think that's pretty much all I have.
Awesome, man.
Did you want anything? Do you want to cover anything else?
Oh, just to have folks make sure they check up and sign up to our mailing list on videogameslive.com. Because we email you when we come to your area. We'll email you before tickets go on sale and send you a link where you can get the best tickets and the best prices before anyone else. And then also join us on Facebook, because like I said, when we come to your area, we create events pages, and we need your help in designing the show and what we want to what you want to hear at your event. So
absolutely. Cool, and the Kickstarter is running all the way through what's the
September 13th is the cutoff date. So and even if you can't donate to the project, please, if you could just put it on your Facebook and Twitter, that would it helps out as much as donating. So yeah, we'd love that.
Yeah, get in there and help out, man. Because cool. this is a big deal for a lot of people.
Appreciate
it,
man.
Tommy,
thank you.
Thanks so much.
Rock on.
Enjoy the rest of your show.
For sure.
So thanks once again to Tommy for chatting me up about Video Games Live Level 3 and the Kickstarter project behind it. It's currently got 8 days left to go. It's about a little under $100,000 short of its funding goal. So go, feel free to pause this, open up your favorite internet browser, head over to Kickstarter.com and search Video Games Live in the search box. Go ahead, do it now. I'll wait. Hey, that wasn't so hard, was it? There you go. Good for you. Thank you for doing that. And that's pretty much all I've got in terms of audio interviews for you guys. If you head over to stealthybox.com, I'll have hands-on written previews, not only for the games that we discussed here on the podcast, but also for games like Secret Ponchos. That's going to be on PS4. WWE 2K14, that'll be on PS3. If you're into Power Slam simulators at all, I got to see the Ultimate Warrior there. I mean, I didn't talk to him, but he looked very sad and decrepit. That was good for me. Dying Light from Techland and WB Games. The Wolf Among Us, that'll be coming from Telltale Games, their kind of follow-up comic book adaptation following The Walking Dead, so that's looking real good. And Octodad, a game that is picking up some steam in terms of just being really funny. So head over to stealthybox.com for all of that. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/stealthyboxes. That'll be plural. We're on facebook.com/stealthybox and youtube.com/stealthyboxtv. You can follow me personally if you're so inclined at Wons23, WONS23. That's all I've got. So thanks once again to all my interviewees for giving me the time of day and sitting down and talking about the stuff that they're so passionate about. And maybe we'll be back with a real podcast someday. Not in the near future, but, you know, soonish, maybe. So look forward to that, maybe, possibly. So talk to you guys on the internet soon, maybe. Bye.